Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. Rethreaded offers hope and a fresh start to survivors of human trafficking right here in Jacksonville. None of us should be defined by the worst things that happen to us. Learn more about how you can unlock the potential of survivors at Rethreaded.com. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a practicing neurologist and professor of healthcare science. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, your trending health headlines in about 60 seconds. Then, our monthly medical roundtable with our experts answering your questions. But first, here are your trending health headlines in about a minute. If we had to describe this month's health headlines, it'd be called a state of flux. First, the state of Florida versus the CDC. The Food and Drug Administration earlier greenlighted updated COVID boosters from Pfizer and Moderna. The shots, which are formulated to target the XBB 1.5 subvariant, are now available. Anyone age 5 and older can get an updated booster shot from either Pfizer, BioNTech, or Moderna, regardless of whether they were previously vaccinated, the FDA said in a statement on September 11th. Yet, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said, and I quote, "I will not stand by and let the FDA and CDC use healthy Floridians as guinea pigs for new booster shots that have not proven to be safe or effective." CDC Director Dr. Mandy Cohen defended the new COVID-19 boosters as proven safe and effective and called the comments from Dr. Latipo, the Florida Surgeon General, and Ron DeSantis dangerous. Then, federal free tests. Just as the summer COVID wave shows signs of receding, the Biden administration announced that it's reviving a program to mail free rapid coronavirus tests to Americans. Starting September 25th, people can request 4 free tests per household through covidtest.gov. Officials say the tests are able to detect the latest variants and are intended to be used through the end of the year. Last, the FDA's nasal spray. The FDA, citing lack of data, surprisingly rejected the approval of an epinephrine nasal spray used for the most severe forms of allergic reactions known as anaphylaxis, essentially ignoring its own advisory committee recommendations. Those are your monthly health headlines in about a minute. Now, joining us today to add perspective and to delve into these headlines for our monthly medical roundtable show are an all-female medical powerhouse team. We have Dr. Tina Arden. She is a family medicine practitioner from Mayo Clinic here in Florida. Dr. Arden, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's so good to have you here. Also joining us in studio, Dr. Sarah Bowden. She's a board-certified anesthesiologist and a community practice physician here in Jacksonville. Dr. Bowden, welcome.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here. Thank you very much.
We are glad to have you here. And Dr. Andrea Nemes. She is a board-certified obesity practitioner and an emergency medicine physician. Dr. Nemes, welcome as well.
Thank you.
Well, let's get started. I'm going to start with you, Dr. Arden. Let's get into COVID, such a common theme, and we're going to focus on the vaccines. As you heard in the intro, Florida Surgeon General urged people under 65 years not to get the COVID-19 booster. Dr. Latipo claimed the federal government wasn't being safe about the risks. So Dr. Arden, let's just get right to it. Tell us about the newest COVID-19 boosters, just like you tell any other patient that you see.
Yeah, so really, I think the way to think about the new COVID vaccine is this is the vaccine for today's COVID. I think the analogy that works best for patients is to compare it to our flu vaccine. So every season, we prepare ourselves against flu by getting a flu vaccine. And so we're in a similar situation now with our COVID vaccines, where this is the 2023-2024 COVID vaccine for this season.
Who exactly is supposed to get this booster?
I say everyone 6 months and older can and should get their COVID-19 vaccine. So as you already explained, for our patients who are 5 and older, all they need is this season's vaccine, a one-dose vaccine, to be considered up to date. We have a couple of exceptions. So if we have our little ones, 6 months to 5 years, who haven't received any COVID vaccines, they will follow a little bit of a different schedule to complete their series. And for our patients who are older and immunocompromised, who again have not received any COVID-19 vaccines up to this day, they'll follow a different schedule as well. So those folks, I just encourage you to talk to your doctor to make sure you're following the right schedule.
No, this is definitely not a political show. And I just gave somewhat of a political introduction, not because I chose to, but that's because those are the facts of what people said. So I'm going to ask you the question this way. What are you advising your own patients, regardless of what's happening state, federal level?
My patients know I'm not political either. My job is to give them the best recommendations with the information that I have. And I practice in a way, too, that I will never recommend something to a patient I wouldn't recommend for my own family or my own self. So every patient that I'm seeing this season, I'm recommending these vaccines. I think they're safe. They're effective. They're great ways to keep ourselves protected and protect those around us.
One last question on the issue of vaccines, which has to do with the commentary from state officials. What are the risks? Just to play on that side, what are the risks and who should worry about them?
Any vaccine has some risks, but they are quite minimal. So we think about things like pain at the injection site, redness or swelling. Some of us may have more significant side effects like a fever, muscle aches, headache, joint pain. You mentioned the rare cases of myocarditis or pericarditis, but those are, again, quite rare. The risk of actually having those conditions is higher if you get COVID-19. So I feel the benefits greatly outweigh any of the risks that are out there.
That is as clear as I've heard anyone state it, so I'm going to let it stand from that moment. Let's kind of move to an allied but similar topic, and that has to do with COVID-19 testing. I mentioned that the Biden administration announced that it's reviving its program to deliver these free, rapid coronavirus tests to all Americans. And the move comes after the Biden administration stopped mailing free tests back in June. So here we are in the end of September, beginning October, and now they're going to restart it. Now, it seems that weekly hospital admissions involving COVID-19 have been rising since July, and at the beginning of September, they had surpassed 20,000 cases, but that rate is now slowing. As I already mentioned, Americans can order a batch of 4 free tests per household. Dr. Bowden, what can you tell us about these new tests that you can get for free from the government?
Well, I'm glad you brought them up. We're heading into cold and flu season now, and that comes along with it probably COVID as well, since we're heading into a time period where everyone's going to be indoors more, exposed to each other more. The Biden administration has allocated another, I believe, $600 million to several manufacturers to distribute testing. It's the same sorts of tests we've had, the rapid tests, the antigen tests, for use at home. So I went ahead and ordered mine last week, ready to get them. Yes. It's good to have them available in case it does come up and you start getting symptoms. As you mentioned, there's been a slight surge around the country. Florida had a little surge in the August. It seems to be coming back down a little bit now, but we definitely had a surge of cases.
Dr. Bowden, when do you recommend getting tested for COVID?
So clearly, when you develop the symptoms that are typical for COVID, the common symptoms, sore throat, cough, fever, headaches, congestion. Sometimes folks are having additional symptoms like nausea and vomiting or diarrhea. They're atypical symptoms. Those are good times to go get a test. if you are able to have a home test, then that's it's much more convenient. The antigen tests are good for testing if you have symptoms, and mm-hmm. they're quite reliable if they're positive. So if you've gone to get a test and it's positive, you can be quite sure that you do have COVID. If it's negative, it's a little bit less reliable and you might consider retesting.
Just for those who may need reminding, and it's been a little bit for some of us who have not had COVID for a long time, but could you remind our listeners, if the test comes back positive, what do they need to do?
Great question. So if it's positive, you consider yourself infectious. First off, you need to take care of yourself. If you have fairly mild symptoms, then you can take care of yourself at home with over-the-counter types of remedies like acetaminophen or cough suppressants, that's great. You need to pay attention to if there are significant warning signs like chest pain or shortness of breath or serious fever. If a loved one notices your coloration has changed, like blue lips or abnormal color, those are signs of more serious disease and you need to escalate your care to either a physician or emergency room. Isolation is key. So if you're infectious, you've tested positive and you have symptoms, staying away from other people is very important so as not to spread the disease. And we can go into, if you'd like, more about duration of isolation depending on severity.
Please do, because one of the things I always think of it, once we're in pumpkin spice latte season, that means that there's a lot of gatherings, parties, and that just brings up all these concerns.
Right. So if you're treating yourself at home and you haven't sought, you don't feel like you need to go in for medical care, and you're treating, conservatively. Once you've tested positive, you consider the day zero of your infection the day that symptoms start. With mild symptoms, you need to isolate from other people strictly for 5 days at least. As long as there's no fever for 24 hours, you can go back around other people wearing a mask for about 10 days total. If you have more severe disease, moderate or severe disease, that's a completely different story. Longer isolation periods are needed at that point.
One other question to ask in this topic, and it's only because it comes up a lot. I just read that there is a new consideration about masking up in healthcare centers. So I'm not going to ask necessarily about that because I know hospitals set their own policies and things of that sort. But when should we be masking? Like, is there a time what's the common sense answer to that?
Well, clearly, if you have symptoms of any type of upper respiratory infection, sneezing, coughing, fever, whether you should be around other people to begin with is questionable. If you're acutely ill, you probably should stay away from other people, not go to work, not go to school. If you're recovering from an illness, masking is a very good idea. If you're part of the immunocompromised or other high-risk groups who are going to be more susceptible to getting severe disease, then that's someone who should be masking more frequently in groups, going to the grocery store, going to gatherings, masking, around other people.
I'm going to let that be our bid on COVID. I'm sure something tells me that this is not going to be the last time we talk about it, nor will this not lead another version of our show in the future, because it's an ongoing story. So I'm going to switch the topic a little bit, and we're going to go to an issue that's kind of close, and that has to do with allergies. And the Food and Drug Administration, in a surprise move, as I mentioned earlier, has decided not to approve an epinephrine nasal spray that would have been the first needle-free alternative to epinephrine auto-injectors, including EpiPens. Every time I think of it, I think everyone I know has an EpiPen for some reason or another, for just different reasons. Now, the agency told the drug maker ARS Pharmaceuticals that it needed to conduct another study on the drug called Neffy to support the approval. And the company said in a statement last Tuesday that the rejection came despite the agency's advisory committee voting in May to recommend approval of the drug in children and adults. It's kind of rare, that the FDA overall overrules its own advisory committees. Now, just as a reminder for folks, epinephrine has been used in the United States since 1901, more than 100 years old, highly effective in reversing anaphylaxis, the most severe type of allergic reaction. Now, the major point of concern during this advisory committee meeting in May was a lack of clinical data, particularly that the drug was not studied in people who were experiencing this emergency. So I'm going to go back to you, Dr. Arden. Just as a reminder, I'm using the word anaphylaxis. Just define for our listeners what anaphylaxis means.
So anaphylaxis is a severe life-threatening allergic reaction. So we might think about having an allergy to something where we have a runny nose or some sneezing and coughing, but this is an immediately life-threatening type of reaction. And so that's why these medications are so important, because they need to be able to help us in that moment until we can get further treatment.
How do you treat this anaphylaxis that people can get? I mean, where people are walking around with these injections.
You mentioned the EpiPen, so that's one of our first lines for our patients who have severe allergies, is to make sure they are always with an EpiPen so that they can administer that whenever they are concerned about developing that type of reaction. But then those patients always need to get to an emergency setting so they can get further care. And so those medications that we administer in an emergency setting are really directed towards those symptoms that someone can experience. So with anaphylaxis, you might experience things like a severe itchy rash, trouble breathing, throat closing, tongue swelling, even sometimes some GI symptoms like nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea. So we will support patients with antihistamine medications like Benadryl to help reduce that reaction, oxygen to help support their breathing, maybe even more epinephrine, and some medications called steroids to help reduce that body's reaction to whatever that allergy is.
And when we're talking about an allergy, it can be an allergy to anything.
Absolutely. I think the common ones we think about are maybe food allergies, maybe an allergy to a bee sting, but it really can be almost anything.
So I mentioned this a little in the intro. What happened with this nasal spray? I mean, that sounds like if I don't have to do a needle, I'm the first one to sign up.
It sounded disappointing, of course, because especially for our pediatric patients, a needle-free option would be amazing to think about. And we certainly have our adults who are pretty scared of needles or needle phobic as well. So having an alternative would be great. But you hit on the major point that the FDA just felt there wasn't enough data to support the patients who would actually use this medication. And so they're asking for more research and data before they can make an approval.
Could the spray get approved in the future?
I think so. So I think that they know what work they need to do, what data they need to collect. And I believe that their hope is to be able to get that done before the end of 2024.
Since you're in family medicine, let me ask you, is this a big topic from patients and for people that you see?
Absolutely. And we know there's been challenges even with epinephrine as well in terms of cost and availability and remembering to carry your EpiPen with you, maybe even administering it. Sometimes some patients need some education with that. So to have an easier mechanism to give yourself epinephrine would be amazing.
Amen to that. So we all can't wait from that direction. And to all of our listeners out there, you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, it's our monthly medical roundtable, and we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tweet me at jservin. We're going to pivot to a very different topic, and it's going to go in the area of healthcare overall. And this has to do with the Medicare 10 drug list. Now, the Biden administration, over the month of September, released the list of the first 10 high-cost drugs subject to negotiation late in the month, with the lower prices of the medicines taking effect January 1st, 2026. Now, more than half of the drugs selected are aimed at preventing blood clots and treating diabetes. In fact, the list includes, and I'll just note them here, Eliquis, Jardiance, Xarelto, Januvia, Farxiga, Entresto, Imbril, Imbruvica, Stelara, and Fiasp. And I feel like I'm just repeating television commercials because I think I see ads for every one of those now that I say it out loud. So, Dr. Nemes, you saw the list. I just stated that. What, if anything, surprised you about these drugs?
Well, what surprised me about the drugs is that most of their patents have actually already expired or will be expiring by the time that patients will get the cost benefit by the time 2026 comes around. I believe only one will still be within the patent. So what a patent does for a drug is it allows the pharmaceutical companies to keep prices set at a higher cost. So while I appreciate, the fight, it just seems like it's a little too late because almost all these medicines are going to be in the near future be able to produce as generics, which generics have lower costs.
And if I remember right, the patent life for a drug is roughly, 10 years or something like that?
It is. And some of these medications, you can apply for a second, for an extension, essentially, on the patent. And some of these medications already had applied for the extension, and they're at the end of that extension.
Okay, so it always comes down to money when it comes to this. So I'm curious. I know you're in practice, and are patients complaining of the high price of drugs overall? Not necessarily if they're on the 10, but all meds.
Definitely. Unfortunately, in the emergency department, we take care of a lot of patients that don't have insurance, so we deal with these issues quite frequently. Some of these medications are on our lists, and luckily social workers get very involved to help these patients acquire the medications with coupons and under certain programs if they qualify. But this list is very small for all the medications that are just out of reach for most patients.
Do you think that people or patients this is from more of a personal opinion, but do you think they'll see relief on these drug prices?
On the ones you mentioned, yes.
That's fair.
on the ones you mentioned, yes. Overall, I think it's just going to be little by little.
What do you think about this approach? This is interesting. This is the first time Medicare has gotten into the act of negotiating drug prices. They're in the act of negotiating everything else.
Right.
But I mean, what do you think about this approach? There's a lot of different ways that people can go about this.
Well, I think it's a good start. And they certainly picked some easy medications because, these were already going to be generic in the near future or right now. So, it's a good practice run for them to finesse their approach to the negotiations. And I'm curious to see which medications are going to be on the next list. And hopefully some that, the patents aren't expiring until 2030, et cetera.
One of the things that, and I'll just throw as my extra comment on this, is that I've noticed that already most of the pharmaceuticals that make these drugs are already filing lawsuits to delay, to challenge the pricing. So I guess stay tuned as we get into this. I'm going to pivot to a very different topic, and that has to do with a supplement, drug, medication, and that is CBD. And that's like the med that needs no introduction because everyone seems to know it more than others. And this has to do with CBD in anesthesia. Now, the American Society of Regional Anesthesia and Pain Medicine recently released a U.S. guideline on cannabis use in relationship to surgery. The move was spurred by the increased use of marijuana throughout the past 20 years and subsequent concerns that THC can interact with anesthesia and lead to surgical complications. Now, the most pressing recommendations included screening all patients before surgery, postponing elective surgery in patients who have altered mental status, or impaired decision-making capacity at the time of surgery. That kind of makes sense. Counseling frequently, especially heavy users, on the potentially negative effects of cannabis use on postoperative pain control, and then counseling pregnant patients on the risks of cannabis use to the unborn child. So, Dr. Bowden, I know you are in the world of anesthesia. CBD is everywhere. I mean, you can get it at the Circle K here in Florida. Does CBD and marijuana have drug interactions with anesthesia?
It's an everyday issue for me as an anesthesiologist and probably for about every anesthesiologist around the country. I'm going to clarify a little bit. You're asking about CBD, which is cannabidiol,
yes,
which is one of the compounds coming from the cannabis plant.
Yes.
THC, or tetrahydrocannabinol, is the other and probably a little bit more frequently used and probably has slightly stronger interactions with many medications, including anesthesia. So yes, it has impacts for us every day in the anesthesia world, especially for heavy users. I'm going to slant most of my comments towards heavy users, which is folks who use it either every day or close to every day. The heavier users certainly take quite a bit more anesthesia. They have heavier anesthesia requirements from both a sedative as well as pain control standpoint.
So for those listeners who are out there, what are the consequences of having to take more anesthesia?
Well, we certainly have plenty of anesthesia. Having more of it is, it's
right?
There.
Right.
More side effects is the primary problem there. Is you take more of it and more problems with pain control. So not only does it require more anesthesia to make folks comfortable during the surgical period, but in the postoperative period as well. That's been pretty well established that heavy and regular users of THC, especially less so with CBD, require more opioids and have a harder time with pain management after surgery.
Which I imagine is almost ironic, given that a lot of people take this stuff because they are in pain.
That's right. One of the biggest indications for medical marijuana use is for chronic pain. Unfortunately, it has not been proven to help with acute pain, surgical pain, and it probably worsens it.
So postoperatively, they've had surgery. What happens then? Is it just the pain is worse, or that the pain medication you give someone isn't work as well, or maybe it's both?
I'm not sure that that's been teased completely apart at this point, but if you look at the studies that have been done about postoperative pain requirements, as well as just looking at pain scores after surgery, both are higher. But that's not the only problem. There are significant other problems as well. As you mentioned, if someone comes in acutely intoxicated, issues of making decisions, capability of making decisions about having a procedure, become a real problem, and probably we shouldn't be proceeding with elective surgery if someone appears to be acutely intoxicated. In the short run, after having ingested THC, it triggers the sympathetic nervous system to increase the heart rate, to increase blood pressure. There's a pretty well-established increase in rate of heart attacks and other heart rhythm problems immediately after consuming THC, and that's certainly a concern in the perioperative period. And folks who have used THC recently are more likely to have a postoperative cardiac event, like a heart attack or a dysrhythmia.
Is that right?
That's right. Yep.
Wow. I've always been curious. I know several hospitals don't even, if you've been taking CBD or, for that matter, other compound in marijuana, they don't give that out while they're in the hospital. And so I'm curious, what happens in these folks that they've been using, they go and have an operation, they're not going to, it's not given to them. What happens to these folks? I mean, is it just the pain levels go up? Is there some problem that's suddenly stopping it too?
That's a really good question. So yes, and folks who are heavy users, there is a risk of withdrawal syndrome. Fortunately, most of our surgeries these days are performed on an outpatient basis, and folks are able to get home to their usual routines pretty quickly, so that's not a problem. In someone who has had a bigger surgery and requires an inpatient stay, and they aren't able to get their usual CBD or THC, again, THC is the bigger problem than CBD, there is a risk for cannabis withdrawal syndrome, and the providers and physicians taking care of that patient need to know about the use. For lots of reasons, this is one of them. So signs of cannabis withdrawal syndrome would include things like mood changes, anxiety, anger, irritability, increased pain, abdominal pain, headaches, and that can be pretty hard to handle on top of recovering from surgery as well, especially if it's something that's requiring you to be in the hospital as it is. There are a couple of synthetics that can be used in low doses in the hospital if someone is at high risk or showing signs of cannabis withdrawal syndrome.
Yeah. One last question on this topic, that the guidelines also mentioning counseling pregnant patients on the risks of cannabis use to the unborn child. Is that been an issue? It when I read it, I'm like, it seems like it would be almost self-evident, but is that an issue that you're seeing even in practice from where you are?
Right. Well, I don't practice much obstetric anesthesia anymore.
Understood.
For sure. But I do know that OBGYNs that I know definitely counsel their patients that CBD and THC are not good for pregnancy. They're not good for mom, and they're certainly not good for baby. They are very fat-soluble compounds. That means that they dissolve well in fat, and they can be transported across the placental barrier and make it into the fetus very easily. And they have a myriad of negative effects on the fetus.
I just wanted to put that out there, and I appreciate it. And we're going to go to yet a different topic, and it's somewhat related to our earlier conversation on medications, but this one has to do with the weight loss drug insurance coverage. It came out that the new class of weight loss drugs, that's the Ozempic, Wegovy, that Groupon, of all things, is now selling coupons for six-week regimens costing several hundred dollars instead of more than $1,000. For Americans without diabetes, it's still difficult to get coverage for the medications, and it's fueling a gold rush for the pharmaceutical industry, even as insurers face a mounting campaign to cover them for people who are overweight or obese. And in fact, the day that we are having this conversation, the Washington Post came out with an analysis saying that the number of Ozempic prescriptions specifically had quadrupled since the year 2020. And they're saying that's not for the diabetics from where they're counting. Now, the exploding market's dominated by Eli Lilly, and for your pure disclosure, Eli Lilly is a sponsor of this program, as well as Novo Nordisk, Wegovy, and Ozempic. Those are the big agents that are out there, with several drug candidates in the pipeline. Wegovy is the only one approved by the FDA as an anti-obesity treatment, while the other two diabetes medications are frequently prescribed off-label for weight loss. Dr. Nemes, just give us a short lesson on these weight loss drugs.
Okay. So first, Ozempic and Wegovy are essentially the same molecule.
Okay.
They're GLP-1 agonists. Their delivery mechanism is slightly different, and also the doses between treating diabetes and treating obesity. But it's exactly the same medication.
Okay.
Going back to your first point about Groupon selling it, what they're selling on Groupon is not the actual medication. It's compounded semaglutide, which means they have a little bit of the active ingredient from Ozempic or from Wegovy mixed with something else. And we do not know what that something else is.
Well, that seems like a big detail.
It is. It's not a generic per se where you actually know the formula. There are specialty pharmacies that will take the active molecule and just mix it with things. And sometimes that could be B12. Sometimes that could just be normal saline. But that's kind of how they get around not getting it from the actual manufacturer. So the American Board of Obesity Medicine, the stand is we do not prescribe compounded medications to patients.
Okay.
These can be very dangerous because we do not know what's in them, and they're not regulated. So I don't encourage anybody to be buying semaglutide or Ozempic, and I use that with air quotes, from Groupon.
I appreciate the clarification because I've learned something there. How well do these? Let's assume that you got the pure brand,
the real
stuff. How well do they work?
They work fantastic. Okay. I mean, just as good as a gastric sleeve. Patients are getting amazing results. Patients are having their diabetes reversed. Their A1Cs are going down. Their hypertension goes away. Their obstructive sleep apnea goes away. They are losing weight. And most patients with the two that you mentioned, with Wegovy and Ozempic, the average is about 15%. Total weight loss, but we are seeing super responders that are getting 20-22% weight loss.
Wow. So who should be taking these?
That's a great question. Obviously, a doctor should be guiding this conversation, but the definition of who should be on any anti-obesity medication is anybody with a body mass index, BMI, of 27 with two comorbidities, such as prediabetes or hypertension, or anyone that's class 1 obesity, which would make it a BMI of 30, body mass index of 30 and above. And I did want to just also clarify that Ozempic and Wegovy is not the only FDA-approved medication.
Please clarify.
There are actually several others that we've been using for a long time, such as Contrav, Qsymia, Phentermine, Orlistat, Liraglutide, also FDA approved. So I would, if you are a patient that fits into this category of being overweight with comorbidities or being obese with metabolic syndrome, you should talk to your doctor in spite of whether your insurance might or might not cover Wegovy, because there are other alternatives that we could use. And there are other medications that we could use off-label that are fantastic for weight loss, such as metformin, for example.
Understood. We all know as practicing doctors that there's no such thing as a drug without side effects. So
that's true.
What happens? What are the side effects of this drug?
Very good question. So if we're talking specifically about the class of drugs, the GLP-1 agonists, such as Wegovy and Ozempic, the most common side effects, which are mild immediately post-injection when you start somebody on it, can be nausea, vomiting, constipation, or diarrhea. As the body adjusts, as we titrate the medication, those tend to be very small. The percentage in people that it happens is about 1%, so very small percentage. The more significant side effects that we worry about would be gallstones, pancreatitis, and kidney stones. Okay. Quite often, patients forget to stay hydrated when they're on these medications because they work on the central brain. Essentially, what tells us we're thirsty is the same area that tells us we're hungry. So when you don't feel hunger, you also won't feel thirsty. So it's very easy for them to get very dehydrated, leading to kidney stones or gallstones.
Got it. Is this lifelong? Because I hear the story that if you stop taking it, the weight comes back.
So we need to remember that obesity is a medical problem that is a chronic medical problem.
Okay.
It's the same as hypertension. It's the same as diabetes. It's a lifelong medical problem that is treatable, that can be relapsing. Some patients do gain weight when we have to stop it, but in some patients we have to stop it. For example, let's say they get pancreatitis, or they get pregnant while they're on the medication, and we do have to stop it. You're not going to go through some withdrawal. It's not going to be necessarily dangerous for you. If you're not pregnant, you may be able to get on a different anti-obesity medication. And there's a small percentage of patients where this medicine, you know, really helped adjust their diet and lifestyle and that they may be able to sustain that weight loss without the medication.
Okay. I like the way you framed it. This is a chronic illness and not, I just need it for the wedding photos or as I've actually heard from people ask in that regard.
Yes. Yes.
So let me get to the other big question related to what we've talked about earlier, cost. Groupon wants to give you coupons for something. What type of cost are we looking at for this?
So without insurance, for these injectables, we're looking above $1,000. There are some
per
month.
Okay.
Which would be four doses. It's a weekly injection. So there are, you know, GoodRx, Amazon, that can lower it to about $700, $737. So that is without insurance. Those who are fortunate that their insurance covers it, you can have copays as little as $25 up to, if they're tier three medications, $125.
I just wanted to make sure that everyone's aware that they're not on the inexpensive side.
No, they're certainly not. And Wegovy only got FDA approval a few years ago, so this is a brand new medication that we're talking about. Like I said, there are also other anti-obesity medications that are cheaper that we can kind of use in combination to get the same effects. So this is, if you are in the category where you are obese, you should be talking to your doctor or an obesity specialist that knows all their options and all the tools that they could use to treat you. And you could find obesity specialists if you go to abom.org, American Board of Obesity Medicine.org. There's a little search category where you could search for physicians that are licensed in your area.
And we'll let that be our last word for this topic. Up next, our experts answer your questions. We'll be right back. Ooh, Mr. Postman. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and this is What's Health Got to Do with It. That music tells us it's time to open up our social media mailbag. Our producer, Stacey Bennett, joins us now to help get your questions answered. Hi, Stacey.
Hi, Dr. Joe.
It's great to have you here. What do we have?
Well, our first question comes from Ellie from Washington, D.C. Ellie says, I am 23 years old, healthy, and active, and I don't take any medications. My parents keep asking me to connect with a primary care doctor. Why should I bother if I'm fine?
Dr. Arden, as a primary care physician, this seems like an existential question, but I hear this from people that age.
I do too, yes.
Help answer the question for Ellie.
Well, I'm so glad that Ellie is healthy, and that's how we want to keep it. And that's part of my job as a primary care physician is to keep my patients as healthy as possible. So I would encourage every patient to have a primary care physician for that reason. At 23, I can think of several things off the top of my head that I could help her address, making sure that she's up to date with vaccines, which we've talked a lot about today. She's due probably for a cervical cancer screening, and we can talk about her gynecological health. It's also a great opportunity to make sure that that patient has somewhere to go if something should happen, right? So again, our hope is always our patients will not need us very often, but particularly this time of year, we talked about COVID, we're thinking about influenza. You don't want to be scrambling to get good care if you're not connected with a good primary care physician. So it's all about prevention and planning for the future too.
Such good advice. What else do we have, Stacey?
Jessica in Phoenix says, I am so concerned about everything in the news. Climate change, social media, politics, abortion rights, etc. You name it, it makes me worry. My question is, when is it normal to be anxious, and when is it considered to be abnormal if you are anxious?
Dr. Arden, I'm going to point this one back at you, and I'm listening to your answer because I feel the same way as Jessica here.
I really think this type of question actually has been more common in the last couple of years. So the pandemic really opened up a lot of thoughts within us and within our communities and in our society. And so this is actually a very common question I get is, when do I need to be worried about being worried? You know, anxiety has a role in our lives. It actually can be helpful and protect us in certain situations. So if you think about maybe driving in rainy weather, we want to be a little bit anxious so that we're careful, we're paying attention. It's when that starts to affect our daily life and our functioning and our ability to enjoy our activities, our schoolwork, our jobs, our relationships, our hobbies. Those are, to me, are always clues that we're dealing with something that's more significant. I've actually had some of my patients on what I call Google restrictions or social media restrictions for these very reasons. And it can be actually quite helpful to think about disconnecting because we were just not built to know about all these things that are happening around us. And so I'll just encourage some of the listeners out there to maybe think about what those types of things look like in your daily life. But again, those are the clues I'll look for is how much is this affecting your day to day? And there certainly are ways that we can help our patients that are struggling with more generalized anxiety.
That's great. What else, Stacy?
Jed in Atlanta says, every time I see my doctor, I fill out lots of forms and questions about my family history. I'm generally healthy. When does someone like me need to worry about family history?
Dr. Bowden, I'm going to point this one at you. What would you tell Jed?
Boy, I have to fill out a lot of forms, too. It seems like over and over and over again. It would be really great if there were some way, in a universal way, to forward those answers between providers. That being said, family history is a potential contributor to all kinds of different medical problems and diseases, even if you don't have any signs of them yourself. So having your practitioner or your physician know what you have in your background might help them make sure that you get appropriate screening for various tests, or for various conditions. Heart disease and cancer are two big ones that come to mind, although there are many, many, many others. If you don't have those diseases early, but your risk for having them is increased, then you can undergo appropriate screenings earlier in life. If your risk for that disease is elevated, you can potentially take take steps to decrease your risk, whether it's a lifestyle change, improving your diet, stopping smoking. If you have a cancer risk, for instance, one very specific disease, breast cancer, has a very big genetic component, sure. And you can potentially undergo genetic testing for certain diseases. So I've only touched on a couple, but there are many, many, many diseases which it's very helpful to know if you have a risk to get so that you can prepare for testing or changing your lifestyle.
Well, we have time for literally just one more question. Stacy, what is that?
Let me reach to the bottom of the mailbag here. Erica in St. Paul, Minnesota. There is so much written about the opioid crisis. I'm scheduled for hip surgery in a few weeks. Are opioids okay to take for pain after your operation? How much of an opioid is too much or dangerous for addictions? What other medications can help for pain after surgery or a procedure?
Dr. Bowden, I'm going to point it to you. It's such a common issue.
It's a huge issue now with the growth of the opioid crisis, and a great deal of folks who have problems with opioids have gotten their first taste of them, if you will, after having had surgery. What is a safe dose and how long is it okay to take opioids? That is variable for everyone. There are people who have higher risk for developing a problem with an opioid than others, and I'll go through some of the risk factors for opioids. I will say that the medical community is making a huge effort to decreasing the use of opioids, both around surgery and in other venues. Most states, Florida included, have really upgraded their state prescribing guidelines with encouraging of very much shortening duration of prescriptions to much shorter, fewer number of days for acute pain. It's different for chronic pain management. That's another story. Around hip surgery, joint surgeries, many places have enhanced recovery after surgery protocols, which involve surgeons, anesthesiologists, hospitalists. The programs are designed to optimize patients' outcomes and decrease how much opioid they need, both in the immediate post-surgical period as well as post-operatively. Some of the things that make folks more likely to have a problem with opioids after surgery are to develop an addiction or a history of addiction in the past themselves, like either to other drugs or to alcohol. advanced age, folks over, I believe, over 50 are a little bit higher risk. Folks who use tobacco or dependent on tobacco, folks with a history of depression or psychosis, all of those folks may have a little bit higher risk of developing an opioid dependence. The important discussion to have around surgery is with your surgeon and anesthesiologist about how can I decrease my use of opioids? What other medications can I use? There are an array of other medications. Acetaminophen is a good postoperative medication. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs are being used a lot more heavily now and helping decrease how much opioid. In the operating room, we're using far more regional anesthetic techniques rather than opioid-heavy techniques to decrease how much opioid someone needs immediately in the surgical period, and many, many other drugs as well. So the whole medical community is doing everything we can to try to decrease your risk of developing opioid dependence.
We're going to let that be our last word for today. I want to thank our tremendous trio here of fantastic doctors. We have Dr. Tina Arden, a practicing family physician at Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville. Thanks so much for coming over and joining us today.
It was really wonderful. Thank you so much.
You bet. Dr. Sarah Bowden, she is a practicing anesthesiologist and obesity physician as well.
And burgeoning obesity physician.
Yes. So we're excited. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
And last but not least, Dr. Andrea Nemes. She's an emergency physician as well as an obesity physician. And I want to also give her a shout out. She helped us with our last week's show. She couldn't make it because of laryngitis, but she sounds great today. So we're just happy to have you here.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to come.
Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Stacey Bennett is our senior producer. Brady Quorum is our director. Next week's program is a special conversation with Jacksonville's Chief Health Officer, Dr. Sunil Joshi. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, email us at health@wjct.org, or tweet me at jservin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. The American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And ReThreaded restores choice and breaks the cycle of generational trauma for survivors of human trafficking in Jacksonville, Florida, through business. You can help. Learn more about ReThreaded survivor-created goods at the storefront or ReThreaded.com/shop.